This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Earlier this month, the fourth Summit of the Americas came to Argentina. Heads of state from all nations in the Americas except Cuba met for talks on trade liberalization. Meanwhile, activists, students, and NGOs from all over the Americas, including Cuba, also came to Argentina. The third People's Summit of the Americas was a forum for grassroots alternatives to global capitalism. Steve Stewart is the International Secretary for the IDEA Network. It's an international coalition that works to defend public education from neoliberal policies. He was at the People's Summit, and he joins us in the studio to say more about what the People's Summit means for the ongoing campaign against economic globalization. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Before we talk about the recent summit in Argentina, remind us what happened in the last Summit of the Americas in Quebec City.
Well, the last summit took place in April of 2001, and I think particularly in Canadians' minds, the image that's left are the 3 days of street battles that took place. It was sort of a classic summit that was similar to the WTO in Seattle and Cancun after that. In that you had the heads of state sort of behind a wall, protected by thousands and thousands of heavily armed riot police. You had a kind of people summit where people from different sectors from all over the continent debated policies. And you had one large march of the more kind of institutionalized left that kind of marched away from the wall. And you had maybe 15,000-20,000 protesters from the more radical left, along with, although people always say the unions weren't there, there were quite a number of unions also participating in the protests attempting to bring down the wall. So you had sort of two and a half solitudes, to use our Governor General's terms. You had the heads of state inside, you had the protesters trying to take down the wall, and then the sort of quieter, friendlier protesters on the outside. What I found for Latin Americans was the eye-opener there was they never believed that in Canada you would see such levels of repression and also such levels of resistance from the population.
Had the talks in Quebec succeeded, what would the FTAA involve?
The agreement in Quebec was to bring about the Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, to have a signed agreement by January 1st, 2005, and that it would enter into force in December of 2005. And the FTAA basically would extend the North American Free Trade Agreement, although with extra restrictions, to the entire continent from Alaska down to Argentina. The critics say that it would basically lock in forever the neoliberal policies that have been sort of forced onto the Latin American countries over the last two decades.
How was the opposition different this time in Argentina than it was in Quebec City?
I think there were two key differences. On the surface, things seemed the same in that you had a big wall. You had heads of state meeting inside the big wall. You had, again, a more institutionalized left holding a very large march of about 60,000 people through the streets of Mar del Plata, a small sort of beach city. And you had, following that big march, perhaps 10,000 more radical protesters challenging the wall and facing tear gas. So on the surface, it seemed very much the same. I think the key difference was that this time the opposition was both inside and outside the official summit. We had in the march at the rally, at the end of the march, we had Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela, address the crowd and receive the declaration of the People's Summit, which he agreed to take to the official summit and read inside. At the same time, actually, this summit was only possible because the heads of states agreed not to talk about the FTAA. Between 2001 and 2005, there's been major sort of shifts in the sort of positions of the governments, particularly in South America, and it was not on the agenda at all. Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. tried to force it on, and the government of Argentina refused to allow it to be put onto the agenda. And this led to very undiplomatic language between those five nations in the south, in South America, make up most of South America, and those who back the U.S., Canada, Mexican initiative.
How has the recent economic collapse in Argentina changed the face of opposition to globalization?
Well, that was one of the interesting parts. In 2001, when they decided to hold the fourth summit of the Americas in Argentina, Argentina was under a government that was staying loyal to the neoliberal diktats of the IMF and the World Bank. Within 10 months of that agreement, that government was brought down by street protests. They went through a succession of five presidents, an interim government, and finally an election where they were kind of surprised by a sort of candidate that took a centrist position in the elections and then moved to the left. And so that's one of the reasons there's been such a long delay in holding the America Summit, is they're trying to find a way around having it in Argentina, and also trying to find to have made some progress in the FTA negotiations before holding it. They were unable to, and they held the conference anyway. The collapse of the government in 2001 was brought about by basically bleeding the country to death. For a decade, it had been following to the letter the dictates of the IMF in privatizing everything, having a peso parity to the dollar, and all sorts of economic policies that basically brought poverty rates in the country from 20% to 50% of the population. And I think as a result of that, Argentines seem much more aware than in most countries of the direct connection between international trade agreements and international bodies.
Because that kind of thing happens in lots of different countries, but people don't make that connection.
Yeah, I think in many other countries, people blame their governments.
Right.
And the governments have a role in it. But unless they're willing to make a clear break with the sort of established order, they're kind of trapped into following the dictates of the, because they're indebted countries. And that's one of the reasons to keep the debt going, even when countries know that it can't, or when the creditors know it can't be paid back, because it means they can control the internal policies of those countries. In Argentina, they went too far, basically, and it brought about a collapse. All sorts of experiments and alternative economics happened. People learned that you could lose the neoliberal economy and still create your own economy. That economy is a fact, no matter what happens. And they, I think, to an extent, lost their fear of the international lending organizations. But they also made the connection much more strongly. So in early November in Buenos Aires, you couldn't walk 2 or 3 meters without seeing anti-Bush, anti-FTA posters, massive posters all over, some put up by the municipality. And the best graffiti I saw there was Bush, get off the planet. but the main sort of center-left Labor Central declared a general strike on the day that George Bush arrived, and it was fairly well adhered to. So the entire, about half the population of the country went off the job on the day that that Bush arrived. So you saw a real sense of connection. And this, I think, buoyed the Argentine president to take a very strong stand despite the intense pressure.
What was the official theme, I guess, of the Leaders' Summit was creating jobs to fight poverty and strengthen democratic governance. What did the leaders actually talk about?
In general, it seemed, at least from the press reports, because again, I wasn't inside the official summit, but most of their time was spent fighting on whether or not the FTA should be back on the agenda or not. There was some talk, again, Hugo Chavez presented a proposal. He sort of came into the summit with some strength because the week before, UNESCO had declared Venezuela free of illiteracy, becoming only the second country in the Americas after Cuba to achieve this. And he put forward a proposal on combating poverty of a sort of Americas-wide initiative to end poverty in the Americas, and committed $10 billion a year from Venezuela towards this. The other countries didn't seem to take this up. And again, most of the focus was trying to get a kind of declaration that everyone could agree on. And in the end, they couldn't agree on it, and they put the two positions in the declaration, one calling for reestablishing of the FTA talks and the other saying that the FTA was harmful to the peoples of the Americas.
Now, since the last summit of the Americas, five South American nations have formed a trading bloc outside of the FTAA. How is trade between these countries organized differently than it would have been under the FTAA?
Well, I think the key difference there is that you don't have one large power sort of imposing. The fear that most critics of the FTA have is that once it's signed, Canada and the U.S. will dominate the trade and export services and manufactured items in return for low-price basic products. What's happened in South America is you have a dangerous combination from the point of view of the North, in that you have Venezuela, which is very rich in natural resources. You have Argentina and Brazil, which are very powerful in manufactured items, forming a bloc in which they can exchange oil for manufactured products. Cuba joining in trading services such as doctors and educators in return for and medical equipment, medicines in return for oil. And so they sort of, they don't meet all their needs, but they meet a lot of the needs that the North had hoped to be able to provide. You have also seen Venezuela entering into agreements with a number of countries outside that bloc in providing oil at rather than exporting it directly to the U.S., because Venezuela used to depend on the U.S. to buy their oil. But they're selling it at a 60% discount using ships built in Argentina to ship the oil rather than the transnational oil company ships. And so, for example, when the president of the Dominican Republic spoke in favor of Paul Martin's push for the FTAA, Hugo Chavez sort of looked him in the eye and said, you know, do you really support this guy's position? And the president sort of didn't say much after that, because there's economic clout there. It's not just like Cuba always had kind of the moral clout, but basically we're seeing the movement to a bipolar America. Well, the U.S. and Canada still form a much more powerful pole. Countries have the option of moving out of that orbit and still meeting their basic trading needs.
Now, some of the issues discussed at the People's Summit don't necessarily come to mind in the context of international trade. For example, you were involved in the Education Forum. Why would how would trade liberalization affect education?
One of the big pushes, both in the World Trade Organization and in any other trade agreement that the Canada and the U.S. enter into, is the liberalization, at least they use the word liberalization, of services.
One of those weasel words.
Yes, meaning that, like, in a way, trading of goods is less important to them than services. The U.S. and Canada both have trade deficits in terms of trading of goods, but in services, they have a surplus, and they have the sort of high education, high technology that enables them to provide services at a lower cost. In the case of education, the goal is to be able to start, particularly through distance education, private schools, private universities in those countries, and sort of sell them at a buck. The education industry is a $2 trillion a year industry worldwide, so there's a lot of, sort of one of the last frontiers you can wrest from government control and make a buck off of. Where it becomes dangerous is when you combine it with a lot of the sort of neoliberal policies in education that have been pushed by the World Bank in return for loans, and one of the chief ones of that is increase in standardized testing. We see it here in BC. We see it all over the Americas, and standardized testing tends to be sort of multiple choice forms that with a good computer program you can mass mark, mass produce. In the U.S. they're already producing some Spanish language ones for their Spanish populations. As soon as, under a trade agreement, as soon as you contract out things such as testing to private enterprise, you have to offer it to any of the countries within the sphere of that trade agreement. So when you see, like in Mexico and many other countries where they have privatized the testing of public schools, you see them become open for being bought out by U.S. companies that can reproduce the tests for Mexico, Colombia, Ecuador over and over again, and so offer it at a much cheaper price than national countries. or companies. When that happens, basically a country loses its sovereignty over its education system, because it doesn't matter what's in the curriculum, it's what's on the test that teachers have to teach to. It's in multinationals' interest to take out the national element so that they can resell the test over and over again. And so you've sort of the combination of these neoliberal policies with free trade agreements, you lock in a system where countries lose control over their public education systems.
So the forum was useful then, because you could all get together and talk about...
Yes. I mean, we talked about strategies for defending, where there's been successful things for pushing back some of these measures. Standardized testing was a major issue that was discussed, as well as distance education and how to move that distance education where it is useful and to the service and control of the people rather than the corporations.
Well, thank you very much for coming in this morning, Steve.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Steve Stewart. He works with the IDEA Network, and he was at the recent People's Summit in Playa del Mar, Argentina.
Canada's Correctional Investigator released his annual report recently on what's wrong in the federal prison system. Topping the list of concerns is discriminatory treatment of women, people with mental illnesses, and Aboriginal inmates. These observations are no surprise to prison justice advocates who have been working for many years to highlight the same issues. The question remains how to turn recommendations into reality and make Canada's prison system accountable for human rights abuses. Kim Pate is the executive director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies. She's joined me on the phone this morning. Good afternoon to you, Kim, in Ottawa.
Good afternoon.
You've been going into Canadian prisons for many, many years and working with women prisoners. What are the major concerns that you have about how women in federal prisons are treated?
One of the major concerns is that we've now had what's probably 16th, 17th report come out chronicling the discriminatory treatment of women prisoners, particularly Aboriginal women and women with mental health issues. And still, in terms of what women in prison are actually experiencing, not the change that we think needs to happen, and obviously more to the point, the women can and should expect to happen. We're still seeing Aboriginal women discriminated against, women with mental health issues discriminated against. And with the exception of some of the women classified as medium security who have better living conditions than they did in the old prison for women in Kingston, minimum security women and women who are classified as maximum security placed in much more difficult, often, living conditions than they had. We also see a lack of accountability in terms of corrections for how prisoners are treated, not a lack of remedial options or access to justice for those whose sentences are interfered with because of the way they're treated in the prison system, and, you know, still overuse of things like maximum security, segregation, and some of the punitive approaches that are taken. So although in 1990 the Correctional Service of Canada indicated they would close the prison for women and start some very new progressive prisons that would be community-based, that would involve women being able to participate in community services, we've seen very little of that materialize.
Now, one of the central issues that was in the Correctional Investigator's report, as you say, ongoing report, but low on action, was on the number of inmates with mental illnesses. Could you just sketch how dramatically that has changed in recent years?
Well, we first started noticing it in the early 1990s at the Prison for Women in Kingston. At that time, there were probably about 10 women of the 100, so approximately 10%, who would have been described as having fairly significant mental health issues. Seven of them were from Newfoundland. So one of the things we started to look at is why, when we had only 13 women from all of the Atlantic region, why we would have such a large number from one of the Atlantic provinces. And not surprising to many people, it was very clearly linked to the cutbacks that were happening and the fact that we saw some of the biggest impact of the economic downturn and social and economic policies that the provinces undertook, first in the Atlantic region. So we saw cuts to social programs, cuts to health care, cuts to education in the provinces that already were struggling in all kinds of ways in terms of their economic base and in terms of the lack of support from the federal government. Then after we saw the cuts in 1995 and 1996, when Canada, the Canadian government, eliminated the Canada Assistance Plan, that left it open for province to essentially spend federal tax dollars in a much more, some would say, independent but certainly arbitrary way when it came to those resources, so we saw further cuts. So what started as, we thought, a particular regional issue, in fact, as we looked more closely, it was clearly linked to the evisceration of social, education, and health services obviously in particular. And in fact, in 1995, when I was visiting Newfoundland, the day that we were in the lockup where many of the women were being held before they were sentenced, the director of the lockup indicated that there had just been an announcement that another wing of the psychiatric hospital in St. John's, which was, of course, the main mental health or psychiatric facility in the province, they'd just announced another wing would close because of funding cuts. And his response was, they may as well take a truck over there, back it up, load up the women, because most of the women there, and bring them over here because this is where they're going to end up because there's no other services. So by default, there'll be something that they can be criminalized for, and there'll be no other options left but to send them there. So then we met with mental health workers who said much the same thing and added that, in fact, behavior that previously would have been seen as symptomatic of a mental health condition, you know, let's say someone's in, is paranoid, is being arrested, is trying to resist that arrest. In the past, that may have more likely been, one, they probably wouldn't have been in this situation, but if they were, would have been more likely recognized as a symptom of their mental health condition and not particularly planned, premeditated behavior, so they wouldn't necessarily be criminalized for it. Whereas then, mental health workers themselves were being told, you know, we don't have enough resources to work with everybody, so better to work with those who are motivated, who want to work with us, who are easier to work with. And if someone's resisting or if someone is in any way doing something that could be criminalized, let's say they're striking back, they're resisting restraints, they're not wanting voluntary treatment, then better to call the police and have those people dealt with that way. So if someone strikes out and it could be considered an assault, then call the police and the criminal justice system can deal with it. So we saw the criminal justice system really become the default for all of those cuts. And so we started talking very clearly not about what used to be our mandate, which is we used to talk about working with women in conflict with the law, but clearly started to talk about the fact that we're seeing an increased criminalization of women, particularly women with disabilities, women with mental health issues, women who are poor, racialized women. Those are some of the trends we've seen, and now we're in a situation where, of course, that's right across the country with the cuts.
What does it mean for a woman with a mental illness to be in a prison?
Well, what it generally means is, first, she may come in on a fairly minor, she may be picked up on a fairly minor offense. The police may arrive because they've been called, that there's been a disturbance, someone may be yelling or screaming on the street, someone may be slashing. And when the police arrive, often they know very well that there are very few resources available, and the only place they can really take them is to a lockup and hope that the observation, that they can be observed. If it's something where there's a complaint, someone complaining that this person has assaulted them or harassed them for money or whatever the issue may be, they may right away be charged with a criminal offense. If in the process of being picked up, they then resist, they may attract additional charges of resisting arrest, obstructing police officer, maybe even assault if they're dealing with someone, or if they actually do strike someone. Then once they're in the system, we've had women resist being strip searched, and again resist in the way that they interpret as defensive but is received as assaultive, and so they may attract more charges. And so what we see very quickly is they may be picked up because it could be fairly minor, might even not attract a criminal charge in the first instance, but it's the fact that that's how that intervention is a criminal justice one, that very quickly they're literally vacuumed into that system. And once they're in the system, it's a very sticky system, and it's very hard to extricate them from it because everything that happens then tends to be seen through the lens of criminality and it's very difficult to then extract from that, pull back and say, you know, if this person was in a mental health facility, was acting this way, they may very well be seen as, it may be indicative of a fact that they're in need of additional support, different approach, that sort of thing. And I just saw actually an excellent piece that Andre Picard wrote, where he talked about if a symptom of cancer was that people suddenly yelled and swore and had, you know, brief outbursts of profanity, would it be seen as they shouldn't deserve any kind of treatment? Would we instead criminalize them? And I think that kind of analogy, while not, you know, the full picture, gives a bit of an example of what happens when people with mental health issues are dealt with in the system. There's a presumption that if they're in control of that behavior, it's a presumption that they themselves are responsible for what's happening, and there's a presumption that it's if they're in the criminal justice, that it's indicative of some sort of negative behavior, and so they're seen through that lens. So right away, as they're coming in, that happens. Once they get, so not unlikely, they'll end up being held in custody. Oftentimes, they'll be told, or they'll believe, or the process will unfold that they may not have access to counsel that are comfortable, aware, competent with mental health issues. Some that are, but then see there are no resources. So it's a catch-22. Even if they have someone who knows the system and knows has worked with mental health issues, there'll be very few resources anyway. So the default often becomes the prison setting. So it's the only one they can't say at this stage, no, our beds are full, we don't have no room, we're not capable of handling these sorts of issues. That really is an issue for the mental health system and for social services, not an issue for the criminal justice system. They'll end up in prison. Because they're difficult to manage, they'll more likely be classified, paradoxically, the more mental health concerns they have or they present, or the greater their psychiatric difficulties, the more likely they'll be held in the most isolated, austere conditions, likely in segregation, certainly many in maximum security settings, because there's three ways you can be classified as maximum security. You have the sentence you come in with, your risk to the community, which usually doesn't apply either of those to these women, but the third way, and the way that most of them get classified, is their institutional adjustment. And so, given what I've already described, it's pretty clear that as they come in, they're not necessarily complying with being strip searched. They're not necessarily complying with following the rules. They may not understand the rules. They may be in the midst of a full-blown psychotic episode, and that behavior will be interpreted as difficult to manage, may be interpreted as dangerous by the staff because the person may be yelling, screaming, swearing, maybe lashing out. And so they're more likely to be kept even in restraints, to be either chemical and or physical restraints, be placed in isolation. And often their mental health issues are exacerbated, so that even someone who comes in depressed, they may place in isolation, who hasn't acted out particularly but is depressed, and so there's a fear that they may be suicidal or self-injurious, would be placed in, and we see women developing mental health conditions in prison, as well as having the mental health and psychiatric conditions exacerbated. And then, of course, the long shot of that is many of them, then there are a few community resources set up, which is the, you know, the tautology or the vicious circle we're back in. So when it comes to community release, many of them are released at the end of their sentences from isolated conditions back into the community with very few resources. So it becomes a virtual revolving door. And so the response with respect that the correctional investigator has suggested of enhanced services in the system is not, in fact, one we're advocating. We advocate that there really needs to be a push from groups like the correctional investigator, ourselves, community, to have those resources in the community, not in prison.
The correctional investigator's report also raises a number of concerns that were recommendations made years ago by the Canada Human Rights Commission and other bodies, one of which was better external oversight and monitoring. What would we really need to have in terms of an oversight body that would be effective from the point of view of the needs of prisoners?
Well, I think one of the things we've talked about, and that goes actually back even to when Louise Arbour did the Commission of Inquiry into the Situation at Prison for Women in 1995, and she recommended that there be limits placed on segregation in terms of the amount of time someone can be placed in segregation, that there be clearer guidelines around the use of that punitive segregation and administrative segregation, and that there be guidelines placed on when someone can be placed in what's called administrative segregation, so things like for institutional adjustment, so that it isn't something that becomes the default for anybody who really needs more human and humane intervention or even mental health intervention. And she recommended that there be a mechanism that allows those cases to be referred to the court for review and possibly remedy, so that if someone has been placed in that situation, even when a judge sentences someone to prison, most judges probably don't think too much about where the person is going. Many do, though, and they wouldn't think that they're sentencing someone to an isolation cell for their entire sentence. So where that happens, this kind of mechanism of either of having oversight both by an external independent body and reference to the courts would allow, in fact, those cases to be remedied. So where someone has been placed in isolation, being able to go back to court and show that, in fact, the correctional treatment they received, quote-unquote, it was not the sentence that was anticipated by the judge who sentenced them, and therefore perhaps the sentence should be cut short, perhaps there should be some form of compensation, whatever might be available. And so we've recommended there be an external body that reports directly to Parliament, and so correctional investigator is one piece, it's a complaint-based piece, though, and this would be also a body that would be able to go in unannounced, do inspections, look at what's happening, be available to prisoners, and also be external, not be a branch of public safety and emergency preparedness, and that there be resources for prisoners, so there'd be like a prisoner defense fund where prisoners could actually access and make sure they have access to counsel, because having access to counsel on paper, as they do in the Charter, and as they do under the Corrections and Conditional Release Act, and as they should have for human rights complaints, is an empty right when, in fact, there's no resources to be able to hire them. So those are some of the mechanisms we've looked at and suggested.
Now, there's one more report that was recently released beside the correctional investigators, and that came from the United Nations Human Rights Commission, sort of mentioning Louise Arbour. That's where she's at right now. And they released a report condemning Canada for human rights violations, and they repeated some of the same findings around federally sentenced women, difficulties that you're familiar with and have been organizing and active around remedying. What do you think of the impact of this report? Is it just another one like the correctional investigators, or can it have some different consequences for prisoners in the situation they face?
Well, doing this for almost 25 years now, I'm admittedly cynical about how much reports themselves can achieve. We went in desperation to the United Nations because we had literally exhausted all domestic remedies, as they refer to them all. We've been to court and court actions, we've done human rights complaints, we've had commissions of inquiry, we've had investigations, and the result still is that we're seeing not a lot of movement. So the fact that the Human Rights Commission internationally has cited Canada, who prides itself on, you know, a country that prides itself on having one of the best human rights records in the world, is important. It's something that Canada says they take seriously and that we believe, you know, is taken seriously in Canada. And I think add to that that the UN Human Rights Commission has said, or committee has said, that they want to report back within a year of how Canada is doing. That's significant, and the reason that it's significant is normally Canada reports on how it's doing on conventions, on how it's adhering to United Nations agreements that we've signed on to. We only report once every 5 years. So the fact that they receive the information and recognize that it's a priority issue, that it is an issue that requires immediate attention, is evident by the fact that this and reporting on what Canada's doing around security certificates and things like what happened to Mr. Arar are really good examples of how seriously Canada's reputation is being questioned at this stage in terms of protection of human rights, particularly for prisoners, particularly for racialized groups, and those with mental health issues. So they paid a lot of attention to Canada's treatment of Aboriginal people, Canada's treatment of other racialized groups. They talked about the concerns about racial profiling in the certificate examples, and they talked about the fact that women prisoners continue to be an ongoing concern. So, you know, wherever we don't, nobody does any, I would think any of this sort of work without the hope that things will change. And it's one of the mechanisms we're looking at. I mean, other things we're doing is trying to work on the ground with some of women who have been inside, women who are currently serving prisoners, to develop advocacy teams to actually assist women in a very concrete, real way in the prison so that they can, you know, both have the supports and information available to them that allows them to challenge as things are happening so that they have some of that process. And if we're successful in some of the recommendations being implemented, then having some, again, more concrete ways that women can participate. So those are some of the things that we're hoping will help to move it along, and at the very least, we'll continue to keep trying to shine a light on what is happening so that Canada doesn't succeed in pretending that we've achieved the sorts of human rights and charter protections that we boast about internationally.
Well, thank you very much, Kim, for keeping the light shining and the work you're doing, and also for taking some time this afternoon to speak with us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you very much, and thank you to Co-op Radio as one of the few that actually continues to monitor this, so we appreciate that.
All righty. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I've been speaking with Kim Pate. She's the Executive Director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies. Information on how to get involved in campaigns to defend the rights of women in prison can be found on their website. Their website is elizabethfry.ca.